Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. Stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, this is the Weekly Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney, so glad to have you back on the show. Well, we don't take ourselves too seriously. We don't take other people all that seriously either, now that I think about it. The world is filled with stupid people. And we don't generally take them very seriously. We also don't tolerate sponsors. We don't tolerate any commercial interruption. We may break for a guitar solo here and there, but it's all news, hard news. Welcome to the show where you get the views that the other conservative talkers, well, simply cannot comprehend at this point. But we're working with them, and we appreciate their efforts as well. And I hope they're all joining me, and I hope you're all joining me, in heartfelt prayer for bad weather in Michigan and Arizona this upcoming Tuesday. Because, folks, this election isn't so much about defeating Barack Obama. It's more about defeating Mitt Romney. At least that's been my main focus. I'm focused like a laser on making sure Mitt Romney does not get elected. I feel like General Patton as he's marching toward Bastogne, and I feel the urge to send up a prayer to the Lord regarding the weather. But I generally don't believe in praying for the weather, for or against it, frankly. But just as less than an inch of snow knocked Mitt Romney out in Colorado, we're hoping and maybe praying just a little bit that there's bad weather in Michigan and Arizona, and I hope you'll join me in that. And also, I hope you'll join me in congratulating Rick Santorum for just not folding up like a $3 suitcase over his overtly religious statements over this past week. I predicted he would fold, and he hasn't. In fact, he's dug in, retrenched on the issues of morality, the cultural, social issues that plague the nation. And I got to hand it to Rick. He's done a good job there. And I think he's a fellow we could probably work with, and like that. So, Rick, you proved me wrong. What can I say? Mitt Romney, on the other hand, has proven me 100% correct in all of my predictions and in everything that I feel. But enough of politics. Let's move on to the cultural, social, moral issues that plague the nation, and we'll start in Washington, D.C. As you can well imagine, we would. I've got an article here from WTOP in Washington, D.C., and the report is that more people per capita in the D.C. metropolitan area sign up for the website Ashley Madison than in any other city. Yes, are you familiar with Ashley Madison? Sounds like a home interior, home decorator, right? It's not. The article from WTOP says, Washington has the highest per capita membership among Ashley Madison's 13 million users. Ashley Madison, ladies and gentlemen, is a website that helps people facilitate adulterous affairs. You sign up and you connect online with other people looking to cheat on their spouse, if you're a cheating spouse yourself. Can you believe that's legal in this country, to have a website to help people facilitate adulterous affairs? Well, that's shocking. But the fact that Washington, D.C., has their highest membership there. There's 38,000 registered users in the District of Columbia. That's not surprising at all. What is surprising and shocking to me is that the Ashley Madison website hasn't been shut down and its founders and administrators arrested, for crying out loud. But there's Washington, D.C. I think I had something else about the nation's capital. Here it is from the Washington Times. A report out last week across D.C., all police districts are reporting increases in violent crime, and all but one of the districts have had a double-digit percentage increase in violent crimes this past year. The crime rate is increasing this year after a downward trend. You remember that big downward trend that the leftist mainstream media has been reporting to you over the past couple of years? This Washington Times article says the number of reported homicides in D.C. last year dropped to the lowest level in 50 years. Yes, that's the good news, right? Allegedly. But this year, here's more great news. This year, Washington, D.C. has recorded just 10 homicides compared with 11 at the same point last year. So it's just wonderful news living there in D.C. amongst all the adulterous cheaters, murderers, robbers, and thugs. Overall, according to the Washington Times, overall, though, incidents of violent crime, homicides, assaults, robberies, assaults with deadly weapons are rising at an alarming pace in Washington, D.C., but registration on Ashley Madison is also increasing in a similar trajectory. Not that the two would ever be connected. No, certainly not. You don't need a strong, stable family unit ruling the city that rules our nation. Heavens, heavens forbid. We know we don't need that. We need more Ashley Madison. Anyway, it's sad what's happening in D.C. It's sad what's happening all over the country, folks. And from our special file this week, the real science file, this is a story about America in general. This is about wireless communications. It's from CNN. The wireless spectrum is a finite resource, and we're going to hit the wall. Almost everyone in the industry agrees that a data crunch is coming. Yes, our wireless airwaves are full. Yeah, the U.S. still has a slight spectrum surplus. You know, that's all the wavelengths and frequencies that we can transmit data and information on. Well, there's only so many of those frequencies, and they're filling up with all these people downloading their contacts at Ashley Madison, I suppose. Let's dig into the story here. Demand is inevitably going to exceed the available spectrum. The reporter for CNN says this: the number one biggest driver is consumers' insatiable thirst for email, apps, and particularly video on their mobile devices. Okay. So I don't know if they're teaching their writers at CNN to write at a third grade level. But let's just analyze that sentence. The number one biggest driver, now that sounds like a third grader right there. The number one biggest driver is a thirst for email, apps, and video. Well, that's three things, but who pays attention to details anymore, especially in the journalism world? I think when you graduate journalism school, when they hand you your diploma, they just whisper in your ear. They say, go out there and just act like you know stuff, and you're a journalist. Well, I understand that you can't write, but that's okay. You're a journalist. Anyway, data traffic is doubling about every year. AT&T says wireless data traffic on its network has grown 20,000% since the iPhone debuted just 5 years ago. 20,000% increase in demand for bandwidth. By the way, folks, for those of you who think America is waning and on the decline, America serves more than twice as many customers per megahertz of spectrum as the next nearest spectrum I can't even say it. Let's try that sentence again. Speaking of, I'm trying to read at a sixth grade level. America serves more than twice as many customers per megahertz of spectrum as the next nearest spectrum-constrained nations, Japan and Mexico, combined. So for a country on the wane and a country in decline, we're still gobbling up an awful lot of bandwidth. But unfortunately, it's for garbage like Ashley Madison instead of constructive, worthwhile endeavors. And so we're going to run out of bandwidth, and then what happens? I don't know. I guess it all collapses. We'll go to a story from Wyoming later in the news because, we can address some of the concerns about the collapse of civilization, which is on my mind a lot, in case you haven't noticed. But I saw a headline this week that gave me some hope for the future, but I'm classifying this as the most misleading headline of the week. This is from the Telegraph over in London. The headline screamed out to me, Richard Dawkins, quote, I can't be sure God does not exist. That's right, Richard Dawkins. I read this to my, I ran out here with my, to my extremely attractive audio engineer. I rushed out with the story, waving it. Look, Dawkins says God might exist. And she said, Brian Dawkins, the Denver Bronco, he knows God exists. Don't say it ain't so. I said, no, no, not Brian Dawkins. This is Richard Dawkins, the world's most famous atheist. She said, Brian Dawkins, I know. Richard Dawkins, I never heard of the guy. Anyway, Richard Dawkins was involved in a debate or a presentation. He joined the Archbishop of Canterbury in a dialogue at Oxford University, and the Telegraph reports it this way. Last week in England, Baroness Varcy, the Tory party chairman, warned of a tide of militant secularism challenging the religious foundations of British society. This is like a century too late, this statement. Challenging the religious foundations of British society? I think they washed down the Thames about 100 years ago. But this young lady is concerned, and we appreciate that. I'm assuming it's a female, Baroness Warsey. Anyway, in England, it's, you know, it's hard to know. But she's concerned about this tide of militant secularism. And so they had this hullabaloo there at Oxford University. Archbishop of Canterbury was there. Richard Dawkins was there. And the Telegraph reports, for an hour and 20 minutes, the two men politely discussed the nature of human beings and the question of their ultimate origin, touching on the meaning of consciousness, the evolution of human language. And for much of the discussion, the Archbishop sat quietly listening to Dawkins' explanation of human evolution. See, that's one of the problems. We've got archbishops sitting quietly while atheists spout off about evolution. And the archbishop actually called Dawkins' description, here's what he said about Dawkins' description of evolution. At one point, he told Dawkins that he was inspired by the elegance of the professor's explanation for the origins of life. So the archbishop was impressed by the atheist. Yeah, and the headline reads, Dawkins says I can't be sure God does not exist. Well, that's because the Telegraph reports, there was a surprise when Professor Dawkins acknowledged that he was less than 100% certain of his conviction that there is no creator. Yeah. The philosopher Sir Anthony Kenny, who chaired the discussion, interjected, quote, why don't you call yourself an agnostic, unquote. Well, Dawkins answered that he did. An incredulous Sir Anthony replied, you are described as the world's most famous atheist. And Dawkins said, well, I think the probability of a supernatural creator is existing is very, very low. He says he's 6.9 out of 7 degrees certain that there is no God. So this is a very misleading headline to emphasize Richard Dawkins in his 0.1% or 0.1% observation that maybe there is a creator. And what I think the headline should have screamed was Anglican Church dead, or Archbishop of Canterbury on his way to hell with jet rockets. That should have been the headline, because listen to this. Again, from the Telegraph, during a wide-ranging discussion, the Archbishop said that he believed human beings had evolved from non-human ancestors, but were nevertheless created in the image of God. The Archbishop also said that the explanation for the creation of the world in the book of Genesis could not be taken literally. That's the Archbishop. That's like the overarching bishop. I'm not too familiar with church hierarchy, but I think the Archbishop's way up there in leadership. And it seems to me that the tide of militant secularism that Baroness Warsey is concerned about has completely deluged the Church of England, and it's washed the Archbishop of Canterbury down the drain. Mr. Archbishop, if you undermine children's belief in the first chapter of Genesis, you have undermined the whole Bible, and you're not qualified to be in the pulpit. Not only children, by the way. If you undermine adults' understanding of the first book of the Bible, well, you're just on your way to hell with jet rockets, and you deserve every bit of it. And if there's anyone who is needed in the hereafter to pull the lever on the Archbishop of Canterbury, I'm willing to arm wrestle Richard Dawkins for that honor. Surprise, you're dead. Guess what? You're never here. I know it might be a little bit of a shock, folks, to tune in to the world's most important Christian podcast and hear the Archbishop of Canterbury himself condemned to hell from the lips of the host. But you heard it here first, folks. But if he doesn't repent, this won't be the last time you hear it. Because we'll all get together on Judgment Day and there will be a giant arm wrestling contest to see who gets to send the Archbishop of Canterbury to hell. And he's going ahead of Richard Dawkins, at least in my opinion. All right. Now, do we have... Well, we're in England again. This is from the Domestic Tranquility File. We're going to continue, folks, because this is the broadcast where we look back on the week that was. We focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought, and we project those out to the weeks, days, months, and even eternity to come. So glad that you're with us. Sad story here from the Domestic Tranquility File. This is from the Courier Mail in London. Jason Lees has taken his life and the life of his two-year-old son. He taught sixth grade at the Anglican Church Grammar School. Speaking of a tide of militant secularism, here we've got a sixth grade teacher from the Anglican Church. We've got a quote from the headmaster at the school where he taught. And here's what the headmaster says about a man who just killed his two-year-old son. This is what the headmaster says. "Oh, he was highly regarded and much loved teacher whose kindness to his students, his gentlemanly approach and enthusiasm for teaching were acknowledged by students, parents, and staff alike. He was an outstanding teacher and a very generous contributor to the whole of our program, not just to the classroom, which of course adds to the shock of the circumstances surrounding all of this." Just shocked. What a wonderful dear man. Now, is this how we speak of a child murderer in modern day Great Britain? Is this where we've come? I need to send a memo to the Archbishop that perhaps the hearts of the people have become blackened and darkened, and their understanding has become murky. This guy just killed his two-year-old son. Dad reportedly stopped his bicycle on the bike path, threw his son over the safety rail on the bridge, and then jumped himself. Both plummeted to their deaths. But other than that, he was a really great guy. Really, just a super fella. Yeah. All right. Now, from the schools of England and the tragedy unfolding there, we come back to Buffalo, New York, the city of my birth. I was one of the last kids born in Buffalo. Since about 1969, people have been just exiting, just fleeing Buffalo. But I was born there. And, well, I left as soon as I could, frankly. A story from the Syracuse.com. Public school teachers in Buffalo can get Botox, liposuction, hair removal, and various other nips and tucks from plastic surgeons, all completely free. And taxpayers are footing the bill. Okay, now a memo to the writer here at Syracuse.com. Again, to descend to a third grade level, you can't say something is completely free and then note that taxpayers are footing the bill. Because if taxpayers are footing the bill, that would imply that it's not free. But again, I hate to just point out the poor language skills of modern-day journalists, but I just can't help myself. And by the way, I barely made it out of high school. Barely. And I never went to college. No. Because when I got out of high school, going to college was for the wussies. The real men joined the Marines. And then I meant to get back to college, but I got distracted by my extremely attractive audio engineer. Anyway, so public school teachers in Buffalo have a perk that's part of a self-insured rider on their employment contracts. There's no copay for cosmetic and aesthetic skin and body contouring treatments. The annual cost for this perk to government school teachers in Buffalo, where I will admit, if you've been to Buffalo, if there was ever a group of people who needed cosmetic and aesthetic treatments, they're concentrated right there in Buffalo. Don't get me wrong. Now, there are some good-looking people in Buffalo. Some of my family still dwells in that region, although they don't go into the city. No, they don't go into Buffalo. That's like Sodom and Gomorrah to my family out on the farm there. Where have I gotten here? Oh, yes. The annual cost of the plastic surgery rider is about $5.5 million back in 2009. This year, $5.4 million. In 2009, teachers enjoyed $9 million worth of plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, aesthetic, and cosmetic treatments. The benefits started in the 1970s as a rider to cover reconstructive surgery. You know, if a teacher was in a fire and needed a facial reconstruction, you know, burn victims, right? Well, the rider took effect long before cosmetic surgery was as common as it is today. In 2003, Buffalo doctors began promoting the loophole that allowed for reconstruction. You could also go in and get hair removal. So some of the few entrepreneurs left in Buffalo are the plastic surgeons and the cosmetic dermatologists. They began promoting the loophole by advertising directly to teachers through their union's newsletter. So Dr. Smith and his plastic surgery practice, he sees an opportunity. He starts advertising. in the union rag that all these communist, socialist, ugly teachers get. And sure enough, you know they're going to beat a path to his door. Anyway, 6 years later, after the doctor started advertising, usage tripled and roughly 500 employees were taking advantage of free cosmetic surgery. It's not free, you moron. The poor people of Buffalo, the productive citizens of Buffalo, and there aren't that many left, they're subsidizing plastic surgery, cosmetic and aesthetic treatments for the government school teachers there in Buffalo. And it's frankly just embarrassing. And it's a wonder Buffalo hasn't slid into Lake Erie already, for crying out loud. Unbelievable. All right. So that's a little depressing to think about the state of Western civilization. By the way, with Buffalo was like the edge of Western civilization at one time. It was like the farthest west you could get. It was the Wild West. There were buffaloes out there, for crying out loud. I think that's why they called it Buffalo. Anyway, hadn't been a buffalo seen in a long time in Buffalo, but apparently there are some government school teachers that resemble buffaloes, at least in their facial contours. But let's go to a story that's, is this more uplifting? Well, it is uplifting in the sense that personhood has yet again made the news more and more every week, folks. The social tension is rising around the issue of the personhood of every innocent person in America. And I mean black people, Jews, and unborn children. They're all people, ladies and gentlemen. It's just a matter of time before we all realize that and codify that in law. And I'm here to help. By the way, going to be a very short blog on the website today because I'm preparing to go down to Colorado Springs to hear a lecture by Eric Metaxas. I did the story last week of how Metaxas the prophet embarrassed Obama, the pseudo-prophet, at the National Prayer Breakfast a couple weeks ago. I'm going to go down there and just shake Mr. Metaxas' hand. And by the way, for whoever it is in the audience that I loaned my book to, Bonhoeffer, you just go ahead and keep it because my extremely attractive audio engineer was kind enough to purchase another copy of Bonhoeffer so I can go down there like a 14-year-old grade school girl and beg Eric, could you please sign my book, sign my book? I am going to get him to sign it. Anyway, let's go to the personhood file. This is from the National Journal. Following the Virginia legislature's decision to table the so-called personhood measure for the next year, the next leg of the battle social conservatives are waging for personhood will likely take place in Oklahoma. Yeah. Now, the Virginia personhood bill was an interesting bill because it wanted to change the definition of person to the moment of conception or fertilization, kind of right where we want it, right at the beginning. But it had an exception for abortion. So the Virginia law, we could care less. It should have been tabled. It should have been flushed down the toilet. It frankly wasn't worthy of being used as toilet paper. An exception for abortion. That figures. You know, the Northeast, it should all just fall into the Atlantic. But follow Buffalo into Lake Erie, for crying out loud. Anyway, so the Virginia law has been tabled. The next possibility is in Oklahoma. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon has said, at the National Governors Association meeting in Washington, she says, quote, there are several bills that deal with when does the start of life begin. Okay. Is there going to be any more embarrassing grammar? This is the sitting governor of a sovereign state, and she says there are several bills that deal with when does the start of life begin. I think she means when does life begin, but who knows? Anyway, she says, well, we'll debate those issues in the legislative session. It's still too early for me to make a judgment call on whether I'll sign it, because it will change between now and the end of the session. But in general, I'm a pro-life governor. Okay, first of all, Governor, you say you're going to debate the issue of when life begins in the legislative session. I would posit that none of you are qualified if you assume there needs to be a debate. Yes, if you assume there needs to be a debate on when life begins, you are not qualified to debate the issue, because there is no debate. You fool! That's first of all. What does she say here? She says, I can't say whether or not I'll sign it because it will change between now and the end of the session. Governor, when life begins is not going to change between now and the end of your pathetic little worthless, meaningless legislative session. Okay? It's going to stay constant. But she says, in general, I'm a pro-life governor. That means if the bill, which the Senate in Oklahoma has passed, and it's on its way to the House, if the bill passes, what she just said, she says, in general, I'm a pro-life governor, that means she won't sign it. Yeah. Well, it means she won't sign it unless there's an exception for abortion. Then she'll sign it. Anyway, I'm not buying what this chick is selling. I can't believe she's the sitting governor of a sovereign state. It's just embarrassing. But National Journal, the reporter here, the journalist, you know, the guy who knows stuff, he says, personhood measures are anti-abortion proposals, which define birth as the beginning... Okay. Which define birth as beginning at the time of conception. Do they not have an editor? We don't want to say that birth is the beginning, that birth begins at the time of conception. That's not what we want to say, Mr. Journalist. We want to say that life and personhood and human rights begin at the moment of fertilization or the beginning of biological development. Birth, we already know when birth occurs. I've been at a couple. No, only one. I've only been at one. I watched the first one, and then I told my extremely attractive audio engineer, please don't make me ever watch that again. Yeah, she said, I don't want you in the room. You get all pale and woozy. Anyway, miracle of birth is a bit of an overstatement. It's not a miracle at all. It's a miracle anybody survives. Anyway, that's beside the point. Let's see. Personhood measures seek to define birth. Okay, so we understand that the grammar of a modern journalist has to be. You have to parse it just to understand what they're trying to say. The journalist goes on to note, no such measure has been passed, but it hasn't been for a lack of effort from the proponents. Yes, we spend more time working on advancing personhood than this journalist spent studying the English language, that's for sure. And certainly more time than the governor of Oklahoma has spent studying fundamental basic fourth grade biology. And I guess we're pretty proud of ourselves in the personhood movement. Remember, folks, supporting personhood does not make you a good person. Being against killing babies barely qualifies you to participate in civilization. It's like the first rung on the ladder of humanity. So we in the personhood movement, we don't want to get all puffed up and think that we're good people. We're just against killing babies. That's barely good. Yeah, I'm driving down to see Mr. Metaxas with an atheist. An atheist friend of mine who he knows that he doesn't necessarily believe there's a God, but he's definitely against dismembering, butchering, and burning babies to death. Okay, he's not necessarily such a great person, but, you know, he's a human being. Yeah, and I am making him buy the gas, by the way. Yeah. I'm going to ride co-pilot. All right, now, let's go to the war file. And the war file this week kicks off in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Oddly enough. I know. Cheyenne, Wyoming. I remember when I first moved to Colorado, I was hanging siding with a mad, insane, alcoholic biker. And one of our first jobs was in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And I thought, wow, this is like the Wild West. I'm going to Cheyenne, Wyoming. And it was really cool when I got there. That we drove up to the state capitol, and it looked like 1879. This is only 20 years ago, but it looked like we had stepped back a century and a half in time. Let's go to Cheyenne from the war file. State representatives in Cheyenne have advanced legislation to launch a study into what Wyoming should do in the event of a complete economic or political collapse in the United States. That's right, folks. House Bill 85 would create a state-run government continuity task force, which would study and prepare Wyoming for potential catastrophes, from disruptions in food and energy supplies to a complete meltdown of the federal government. The group is going to look at the feasibility of Wyoming issuing its own alternative currency, implementing its own military draft, raising a standing Wyoming army, and acquiring strike aircraft and an aircraft carrier.
How many people are there?
There's only like a half a dozen. They've only allotted about $16,000 for the whole study there in Wyoming, because there's only like five old crotchety veterans up there saying, when it all goes down, one thing I know, I want Wyoming to have an aircraft carrier. Speaking of true believers, let's go to Iran. Yeah, I mean, just because you believe in something that's completely false doesn't mean you're not a true believer. And let's go to Iran. The wife of Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, an Iranian nuclear scientist who was assassinated in Tehran back in January, said in an interview last week that her husband, quote, sought the annihilation of the Zionist regime wholeheartedly. So, good work, Mossad. Talk about preemptive action. I mean, here this guy's been dead over a year, and I believe, is this the guy they decapitated with his own headrest with a well-placed explosive? I'm not sure. I mean, Israel has been fairly successful in knocking out these Iranian nuclear scientists to the point where you can't hardly keep track of whose head got blown off and whose didn't. But this fella's head got blown off back in January, and his wife comes out and says, yeah, he was all wholeheartedly dedicated to the annihilation of the Zionist regime. Mustafa's ultimate goal, she says, was the annihilation of Israel. That's a quote from Fatima Baluri Kashani. That's the former wife of the currently dead Iranian nuclear scientist. The quote, according to the article from IsraelNationalNews.com, the reporter says that the quote belies attempts by Iran to claim that its nuclear program is not military in nature. Very much so. Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan is described as a chemistry professor and a deputy director of commerce at Natanz Uranium Enrichment Facility. Well, that's all in the past, because he's been sent to hell by the Mossad. They're very good at dispatching Muslims to meet Allah, especially ones that threaten Israel with annihilation. And like this fellow, he sought the annihilation of the Zionist regime wholeheartedly. And so, I mean, if you didn't realize that already, ladies and gentlemen, you're just not paying attention. Speaking of people who are not paying attention, let's go to the New York Times, who are always quite competent in expressing the views of people who don't know what they're talking about and are not paying attention. They have a story, Dateline Washington, D.C. The New York Times says, even as the United Nations nuclear watchdog said in a new report last week that Iran had accelerated its uranium enrichment program, American intelligence analysts continue to believe that there is no hard evidence that Iran has decided to build a nuclear bomb. Recent assessments by American spy agencies are broadly consistent with a 2007 intelligence report that concluded that Iran had abandoned its nuclear weapons program years earlier. Nothing to see here, folks. Let's not pay attention. So these are, who are these people again? These are not college students sitting around having academic exercises. at night. These are a top American intelligence analysts who conclude there's just no hard evidence. We haven't seen a mushroom cloud over Tel Aviv, so there's really no hard evidence. I mean, they haven't blown anything up with a nuclear bomb. But back to the New York Times article. James R. Clapper, the director of national intelligence, said, quote, "Iran is certainly moving on that path, but we don't believe that they have actually made the decision to go ahead with a nuclear weapon," he said, just prior to being escorted from the building, put in a straitjacket, and taken to a rubber room. Because he's obviously lost his mind. I made that last part up. He's actually still wearing a suit, and he's still analyzing intelligence that you and I rely on to prevent a nuclear explosion here on our shores or on the shores of our allies overseas. He's actually still in that position. So if you were worried about Iran, be more worried. Because whenever our analysts say that there's nothing to see here, you know, like in Pakistan and India, well, nuclear bombs start going off. And that's the last thing we want to see. And here's a gentleman who, if he were running things, at least at the State Department, I doubt we would see an Iranian nuclear weapon. And that's John Bolton. Now, I know John Bolton, I think he endorsed Mitt Romney, and that's fairly embarrassing. But you've got to take Mr. Bolton seriously on his foreign affairs views. And so we do, despite the fact that he endorsed Mr. Romney. Now, he's probably been promised a job in the Romney administration, which would be the only thing the Romney administration has said so far in the campaign that I've agreed with, is that they put John Bolton on at State. But I think Mr. Bolton's stock is rising amongst any of the Republican candidates, especially the conservatives who are running, Mr. Romney aside. From Newsmax.com, former UN-ambassador John Bolton says the Obama administration has gone public in recent days with the pressure it's been putting in private on Israel not to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, because behind-the-scenes effort to prevent an Israeli attack on Iran have been fruitless. Bolton also reiterated that a nuclear Iran would ignite a race in the area for all countries to attain nuclear capability. He says, "It's a terrible signal of weakness to Iran that the Obama administration apparently is more concerned about an Israeli strike than we are about an Iranian nuclear weapon. And I think for Israel, it simply demonstrates that nobody else is going to take care of them." Bolton said, "If they're going to protect themselves, they're going to have to do it themselves." And that's a sad, sad commentary, but an observation of objective truth and reality, that the Obama administration is not going to help Israel. I wouldn't be surprised if the Saudis lend more assistance to the Israelis when they strike than does the United States. Bolton goes on to say, "If Iran does have a nuclear weapons capability, Saudi Arabia will get nuclear weapons, Israel will, Turkey will, perhaps others in the Middle East. You could have half a dozen nuclear weapon states in the Middle East in a relatively short period of time." That's what our intelligence analysts should be focused on, is just clear, simple thinking like this. I mean, connect the dots, boys, for crying out loud. How much are they paying you every year to analyze intelligence? I mean, John Bolton, they won't even let him in the front door at the State Department. He probably can't even get a phone call return from the CIA or other intelligence and defense organizations. But he can see what's going on. Let's see, more from Newsmax. Bolton warned that he's convinced Iran will get nuclear weapons within 2012, within this year. He says the only wild card is whether or not Israel decides to strike. And I think Mr. Bolton is exactly right in that the only thing that's going to prevent a nuclear Iran is Israel. Because here in America, we're supine. We're cowering in front of our Muslim enemies, the fanatics who want to institute a Muslim caliphate. We're supine. We're just begging them not to, please, please don't hurt us. Got a Reuters story here talking about the murderous rampage that the Muslims with their religious inferiority complex have been executing since some Korans were burned. Reuters reports 7 U.S. military trainers were wounded on Sunday when a grenade was thrown at their base in northern Afghanistan as anti-Western fury deepened over the burning of the Quran at a NATO base in Afghanistan. Despite a supine, pathetic apology from U.S. President Barack Hussein Sotoro, riots continue to rage across Afghanistan. Some protesters even hoisted the white Taliban flag right there in front of our face. The Afghan Interior Ministry identified one of its own employees as a suspect in the fatal shooting of 2 U.S. officers at its headquarters last Friday. It was a colonel and a major executed by a treasonous, treacherous Muslim Afghan army official. Not army, I'm sorry, Interior Ministry official. The protests have killed 30 people and wounded 200. And Reuters reports that the Quran burnings could make it far harder for NATO forces to win the trust of the Afghan public as they try to stabilize the country ahead of the withdrawals. Ladies and gentlemen, these Qurans were being filled with little notes so that these little terrorists could communicate one to another when one occupied a cell that the other had left. The Qurans were burned because they were being used against us in plots to do violence and harm to our soldiers. And I would, and you know what? When they came in and said they were mad about the Qurans, I would say, you better tuck your turban in and go back to your house, because if I see one more rock come over that wall, I'm going to burn your whole city down. Every Quran in the city will be burned, along with your houses and your families. Get down on your knees and say, I'm sorry for burning your treacherous, wicked, evil book. We should have been leveling mosques and building churches from the day we walked into Afghanistan. And ladies and gentlemen, that day is coming. Just because this generation didn't have the guts to do it does not mean another generation won't be forced to do it. Because it is a lack of a knowledge of the true Creator God that festers in the hearts of these wicked, evil pagans. And they have to be put down and utterly destroyed. And you would be amazed when you start raising mosques and burning cities how fast they'll line up to convert to anything but Islam. They're slaves to Islam. If we would reach out to these people and destroy their oppressors, who are the Muslim clerics and the fanatical Islamists, crush and destroy them, the hearts and minds of the people would naturally turn to us if we offered them a credible alternative. And ladies and gentlemen, Jesus Christ and his gospel of peace is the best alternative those people will ever see. Why do we not offer it to them? Well, because we've discarded it a generation ago. And so that's why we will never win the Middle Eastern war. Never. Well, at least not with the policies we're following now, the secularist policies. So let's go to WorldNet Daily for more reports on the burning of the Holy Quran that was being used as a weapon against our soldiers to communicate messages between terrorists, killers, madmen, and fanatics. You know, the only thing we didn't do right there, we should have burned the Qurans with the people who were writing the little notes in them. I would have burned them both. You know, that's what the Muslim understands. The leadership of the Islamic hierarchy needs to be terrified of us. They need to exist only in caves in the outer fringes. They're not qualified to participate in civilization. They're not qualified to lead the people of the Middle East, whom they have enslaved for 1,000 years. Now I got a little got a little wrapped up there. Let's go to WorldNet Daily. Experts on radical Islam say the U.S. military is sadly mistaken if it believes groveling at the feet of Muslims after burning the Quran will help win the hearts and minds of the world's Islamic community. The reaction of the U.S. military toward recent reports that NATO may have unintentionally burned copies of the Muslim holy book. It's unintentionally. Yeah. Anyway. That's what Barry came out, you know. All of his people, they got on their hands and knees. It was an accident. We didn't mean to burn it. When the military and intelligence officials said the reason we burned them was because they were using them to communicate. It wasn't an accident. But anyway, I digress. The reaction of the U.S. military toward a recent report that NATO forces may have unintentionally burned copies of the Muslim holy book, the Quran, stands in stark contrast to its response when U.S. forces burned copies of the Bible back in 2009. Remember? They didn't apologize for that. And the Christians who sent the Bibles, they didn't go and cut anybody's heads off. It shows you the difference between us and them. Robert Spencer, founder of Jihad Watch, called the actions taken by U.S. General John Allen in his groveling apology. Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch called that apology offensive. Now, here's a quote from Mr. Spencer over at Jihad Watch. He says, Allen's statement amounts to groveling before Muslims around the world. This is the United States military, and he's the commander of all U.S. forces in Afghanistan. This is embarrassing and an insult to every American. The Qurans were among other books and materials that have been confiscated from Taliban prisoners after military personnel thought they were being used to send messages to other operatives. So there it is. It was not a mistake. The materials were taken to a waste pit and burned. Unfortunately, the Taliban members were not also put in the pit and burned as they should have been. In a supine, groveling, pathetic statement, General Allen said, I've ordered an investigation into a report I received. I received it late at night. That ISAF personnel at Bagram Air Base improperly disposed of a large number of Islamic religious materials. I'm so sorry. which may have included Korans. Oh, I'm so sorry. When we learned of these actions, we immediately intervened and stopped the burning. The materials recovered will be properly handled by appropriate religious authorities. Please don't hurt me. Stop throwing stones at me. I want my mommy. That's the general. That's the general in charge of all forces in Afghanistan, groveling before these maniacs, these savage throwbacks. In a, WorldNet Daily reports, in a similar incident involving the burning of holy books in 2009, the U.S. military confiscated copies of the Holy Bible that a church had sent to an American soldier to use as an outreach toward Afghan citizens. When the military discovered the Bibles, the holy books were confiscated and burned. After the Bible burnings, the U.S. military defended its actions. There was no apology proffered. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Wright says, if the Bibles did get out, you see, it could be perceived by Afghans that the U.S. government, the U.S. military, was trying to convert Muslims. Oh, we wouldn't want that. Claire Lopez, a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, said Allen's penitent attitude will create nothing but contempt among the populace in Afghanistan for U.S. soldiers serving there. She says they value respect and strength. They disdain and will not respect those who show weakness. If the government had showed similar respect for the Bible as for the Quran, they would respect us more than they do. Mr. Spencer from Jihad Watch agreed with Lopez, noting that if Allen's intent was to earn the respect among the Afghan people, he's made a grave mistake. Spencer says, quote, he has no idea how weak he now appears before the people of Afghanistan. They're not going to look at him and think this man is... They are going to look at him and think this man is weak, and America is defeated. And folks, we may have lost this battle, but stick with me because America is far from defeated. Feel like I'm floating, it's dragging me, my head's about to break. Insanity inside of me, it's like I'm wide awake. Feel like I'm floating, I'm hypnotized, these feelings can't be cased. His gravity is killing me, I can't stand. It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm Doug McBurney. We're rounding third and headed for home, ladies and gentlemen. We've made our way out of the war file, barely by the skin of our teeth. We're surviving. Hanging by a thread is Western civilization against the tide of militant secularism flowing from one side and the tide of Islamic extremism flowing from the other side, and we're all getting pinched in the middle here, folks. And now, well, I hate to do this, too, because my extremely attractive audio engineer has... She has noted that I've acquiesced to her wishes to avoid stories about homosexuals because it grosses her out. And I know it's not the most pleasant topic, but speaking of feel like I'm falling, I feel like homosexuals are falling out of the closet at a record pace this week, ladies and gentlemen, because they're probably going to consume the last quarter of the program, and I want to apologize in advance, but I've got to tell it like I see it. Here's an update on a story we did just a few weeks back about the man who gave birth to a baby. The London Telegraph reports that he fears the reaction of his parents. The 27-year-old university graduate, who was born a woman but has had treatment to change its gender, gave birth to a girl March of last year, and he admitted that he's had to cope with the concerns of his family. This deviant, it, said in an interview about his family, "They seem to be okay, but what I'm worried that they may try and convert me back to the way I was because of the perceived mental health of the baby." So he's worried that some people in his family might still be rational and sane and grab him by his shirt collar and say, "What the hell is wrong with you? You're a freak." And that he might feel some guilt over that. And what is the perceived mental health of the baby? I'm concerned for the actual mental health of the baby and you and most of your family, frankly. He says his mom has already told him that I'd be a good mommy. And I told her, "No, I'll be a good daddy." At which point she probably fainted. She probably wanted to crawl in a hole and just hide. He says his mother's gotten used to it. She said says, "I'd hate to have a falling out with my mother and dad over their own grandchild." And they were just weeping in the corner, I'm sure. Another member of the family, an aunt, has not been nearly as supportive as mom and dad. He says his aunt said she wanted to know if I was going to stop being silly and become a woman again. She wanted to know if I was going to get rid of the silly new name I'd adopted. So is she a hater or is she sane? Well, I guess it all depends on your point of view, right? No, it doesn't. No, she's sane and normal. I don't care what your point of view is. She realizes that this thing is a freak. And she's genuinely concerned for her and the child. Let's see. The tranny freak made comments on a blog that it wrote. And that blog's now been removed from the internet. It was on a forum for transsexual parents. Just knowing there's such a thing out there is kind of disturbing. The tranny freak made all these comments that we're reading here on this forum, I should say. Now, folks, try to comprehend this, okay? Just try to follow me through this. Walk with me for just a moment. The Telegraph reports, he was born a woman but had been living as a man for 5 years. He had legally changed his name and gender and had been receiving hormone treatments but decided to attempt to conceive with his male partner from whom he is now separated using his own eggs. I can't figure it out. You can't say his own eggs. It just that can't be. He doesn't have ovum at any time in human history. Doesn't matter what your point of view is. Doesn't matter how progressive you are. Doesn't matter how inclusive you are. He and ovum don't go together. I'm sorry. By the end of that paragraph, I couldn't figure out who was who, for crying out loud. Did he separate from a boy as a woman or a girl from a girl as a man as a woman? I don't know what's going on. And you can see why God condemned this type of deviant behavior from the very beginning. I mean, at the very least, it's just confusing. But it's also utterly corrupt and wicked. By the way, the case of this tranny freak who went from a girl to a boy, this case of a transgendered man having a baby, according to the Telegraph, his case is thought to be only the fourth in the world. There's three others of these out there? Man. Anyway, the tranny said, "I'm not the first man to have a baby, and I won't be the last. But we're not fully accepted and understood yet, and there's still a long way to go." Still a long way to go, he says. It says. So, folks, they won't stop. This is not a fad. A memo to Newt Gingrich. It's not a fad, the homosexual marriage thing. It's not a fad that's going to pass away. What's that? No, I didn't say it's not a fag. He is a fag. I'm saying this is not a fad that we shouldn't be. You know, this isn't like black fingernail polish, you know, or earrings. Well, I'm trying to think of a fad that doesn't date me. Is there a current fad? Bath salts? Is that? Yeah, it's not like Chipotle, something that's going to come and go. This is serious. They will not stop until they utterly corrupt your children and mine. That's what they want. They're coming for us, folks. Take them seriously. All right, speaking of pouring out of the closet, I've only got a few minutes left. I'll try to go through these quickly, ladies and gentlemen. There's been a Valentine's Day contest at St. Joseph's University. It's called the Hawkmate Contest, and it's a way for alumni who met on Hawk Hill, which is, I'm sure, a hill there at the university, to share their love stories and photos. So Hawk Hill is probably like the makeout place there at St. Joseph's University. And the Alumni Society had a contest. Send in your stories and pictures of how you met your partner, spouse, or whatever, and we'll have a contest. Well, these two deviant perverts, Megan Edwards and Katie McTurk, they had submitted their photos and their love story. These are two girls, by the way, just in case you were confused. I know it gets confusing. But, so they submitted their photos and love story, but they weren't able to get the photo posted because the Alumni Association refused. Why? Well, because they're a couple of dykes, and it's kind of disgusting. They're trying to have a family-friendly contest here, and you got a couple of dykes who want to take it over. By the way, St. Joseph's calls itself a Catholic university. The Alumni Association, according to this report from NBC in Philadelphia, the Alumni Association posted the lesbo hawkmate photo and their pathetic little love story after quite the controversy erupted, which is what these homosexuals are good at, generating controversy and making normal people feel guilty for being disgusted at their deviant behavior that threatens the future of Western civilization. We shouldn't be embarrassed about that. I'm not embarrassed to be disgusted, but apparently all the other progressive liberal alums from St. Joe's were embarrassed. So when they finally let the dykes submit their story, it easily won the contest. And they are now the champions of the How I Met My Hawkmate contest at St. Joe's University. By the way, the dykes plan to marry next year. Yeah, that's just wonderful. Another story from Boston. Three women, identified by their lawyers as lesbians, were arraigned last week on a hate crime charge for beating up a homosexual man. Try to get your brain around that. Three lesbians beat up a homo, and now they're being charged with a hate crime. Well, the American Civil Liberties Union has joined the side of the prosecution in an odd twist, because the hate crimes legislation is the holy grail to the ACLU, and they want to make sure that it's applied evenly, no matter what kind of deviant pervert you are. If you beat up a homosexual, you obviously did it based on bias against homosexuals, even if you're a homosexual. Yeah. I've got a quote from the defense attorney for the lesbians. His name is Javi Silvagate. He's a lawyer. Yeah, he's a lawyer. Javi. He says, this really demonstrates the idiocy of the hate crimes legislation. He says, if you beat someone up, you're guilty of assault and battery on a human being, period. The idea of trying to break down human beings into categories is doomed to failure. Wow, there's a lawyer actually talking sense. Anyway, but he's hired on that side, so yeah, okay. Prosecutors in the ACLU of Massachusetts says no matter the defendant's sexual orientation, they can still face the crime of assault and battery with intent to intimidate, which is way worse than just assault and battery. I don't know, whenever I've been insulted or battered, I've felt intimidated, whether they cared anything about my personal life. When someone starts punching you in the face, it's fairly intimidating. I've noticed. But they've added that. The crime of assault and battery with intent to intimidate. Yeah. The ACLU attorney, Sarah Wunsch. My name's Sarah. I work for the ACLU. I'm a lawyer. So lawyer Sarah. She says, someone who is Jewish can still be anti-Semitic. The mere fact that someone is a member of the same class doesn't mean they could not be motivated by hatred for their very own group. Right? Yeah. I mean, you follow, right? What's her name? Sarah Wunsch. Anyway. Let's see. The mother of the two of the dykes involved in the beating of the queer told reporters that the alleged attack can't be hateful because both my daughters are lesbians. The victim, he's a queer. So that was, they weren't hating him as they were raining blows down upon his head. That wasn't hateful in any way. It was just violence, raining punches down on his
head. That's not crime.
No, it's generally a loving type of interaction. The two sisters and one of their domestic partners beat the man, repeatedly punching and kicking him after he bumped them with his backpack on a stairwell. You know how annoying that can be. Yeah. The victim, who suffered a broken nose, told police that he believed the attack was motivated as a crime because of my sexual orientation. Because the women called me insulting homophobic slurs. Is there gas escaping? Oh, no, it's just a queer talking. Anyway, the attorney for the dyke says that it was the queer who was the aggressor, and he used racial slurs against them. I mean, you've got different races and various sexual deviant perversions all intermingled, and it's just, it's disgusting. Now I know why you don't like me doing these stories, because it's just disgusting. But here's something that's not so much disgusting as disturbing from Chicago. This is from the Associated Press. Dateline Chicago, a small but growing number of teens and very young children who think they were born the wrong sex are getting support from parents and from doctors who give them sex-changing treatments. This is according to a report from the medical journal Pediatrics. The AP reports an 8-year-old second grader in Los Angeles is a typical patient. Born a girl, the child announced at 18 months, "I a boy." That's what the girl, 18 months old, she said, "I a boy." And so her parents naturally took that seriously. The family was shocked, but now refer to the child as a boy and is watching for the first signs of puberty to begin puberty-blocking drug treatments for this child, an 8-year-old. They're getting the drugs ready to drug this kid out. Now, Dr. Norma Spack is among the doctors who think that these children may have brain differences more similar to the opposite sex. Spack says by some estimates, 1 in 10,000 children have the condition of a gender identity disorder. I think they have a parental disorder. Parental identity disorder. Parents who refuse to identify themselves as parents and instead acquiesce to the ravings of an 18-month-old for crying out loud. "I a boy." "Oh, we better take that seriously, my dear. She thinks she's a boy. She's 18 months old. Put a dress on her. Teach her to be a girl," for crying out loud. Let's see. The report says offering sex change treatments to kids younger than 18 years old raises ethical concerns. Just concerns. I'm sure we can figure out a way to do it, says Dr. Megan Moon, a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She says there's concerns. She doesn't say it's outrageous, it's abusive, it's criminal. She says, there might be some ethical concern. Let's sit down, let's debate it. Let's talk it through with the lawyers. Sure, we can figure out what to do. But Moon does warn that it is harmful to have an irreversible treatment too early. Duh, yeah, you think? Letting an 18-month-old believe that they were born into the wrong sex, that could be problematic. Doctor, did you have to go to medical school to figure that out? All right, back to the article here from the Associated Press. Current guidelines, and there are guidelines on this, ladies and gentlemen, that alone is a huge red flag. Current guidelines recommend puberty-blocking drugs until the age of 16, then lifelong sex-changing hormones. There's a group that wrote these current guidelines. It's called the Endocrine Society, and the group's members are doctors that treat other hormonal conditions, you know. You got thyroid problems when you're in your 60s. They recommend something for that. You got a 12-month, 18-month-old who's not sure if he's a boy or a girl. Hey, we got some drugs for that too, Mom, Dad. Just go on about you. Yeah, go to work. We'll take care of the kids. Don't worry. Let's see here. YouTube videos by sex-changing teenagers have helped raise awareness about the treatment and have led more families to seek help. Yeah, help. The youngest kid to undergo this abuse was 4 years old. Kids that young, they get they're monitored until the first signs of puberty emerge, usually around the age of 11 or 12, and then the children are given puberty-blocking drugs. The monthly cost for such drugs is about $1,000 a month. I see, so there's money to be made in this. No wonder they're promoting the YouTube videos and offering family, oh, we've got all the help. You need help? Come on over here. It's $1,000 a month. We'll help you out. Man. Let's go to the Telegraph in London. Zach Avery, now 5 years old, has been living as a girl for more than a year after he first refused to live as a boy when he turned 3. Little Zach was just 3 when he began refusing to live as a boy, instead choosing to wear pink dresses and ribbons in his long blonde hair because he has gender identity disorder. So the reporter writing for the Telegraph just writes because he has gender identity disorder. He writes that as if it's the gospel truth. There's no allegedly or he thinks or his parents suspect he may have gender identity disorder. The reporter just says it, matter of fact, because he has gender identity disorder. But if we have video of a man shooting another man, it's all alleged. But this is the gospel truth. Let's see. The primary school that this young... is this a boy or a girl? A boy. The primary school that this boy attends has even changed the kids' toilets to gender-neutral unisex bathrooms just for little Zach. His mom, a 32-year-old airheaded criminal child abuser, said that Zach used to be a normal little boy, but suddenly he decided he wanted to live as a girl. He became obsessed with Dora the Explorer and started dressing in girls' clothing. And mom didn't know what to do. She had to acquiesce to the will of the child because she's been taught you can't discipline, you can't train a child. You have to let a child follow their heart. You know, even if they're confused, vacuous children who need an education, who need leadership, guidance, training and discipline from a grown adult, which unfortunately this child did not have in his life. Mom. Unbelievable. Mom became worried about Zach's behavior, and so she took him to the doctor. Now, if you're worried about your child's behavior, why would you take your child to a doctor? I mean, I can understand if the kid's got a fever, you know? If he's got a really bad rash, I'm taking the kid to the doctor. But if I'm worried about my child's behavior, I'm probably going to talk to my wife and my pastor. I'm not going to take him to a doctor. But in today's modern brainwashed, drugged-out age, the natural thing to do for a confused, vacuous airhead who happens to have a child is to take the kid to a doctor when she can't figure out how to raise him. So she took him to the doctor. She told the doctor he'd become upset if anyone referred to him as a boy. He used to cry and threatened to cut off his willy. That's what he used to do. So there's a sign that the kid is just an undisciplined little brat. And if you allow an undisciplined little brat to take his furor and rage and anger and his rebellion to the nth degree, you're going to end up with Adolf Hitler. This is what Adolf Hitler was. So no discipline for the kid. Let's see. The doctors that mom brought her brat to, the article refers to them as dedicated specialists. Well, the dedicated specialists explained to the confused, foolish, vacuous, stupid, airheaded mother that the gender identity disorder is a conflict between a person's actual physical gender and the gender that that person identifies himself or herself as. Mom says they told us that although he had a male body, his brain was telling him he was a girl. These are doctors making a recommendation to a layman. This is shocking to me. This is shocking that we have come this far. This is in Britain, by the way, which is just a sign that the archbishop back there, he's just at the tip of the spear on the way to hell. I mean, the whole country, the religion in England has been completely and utterly destroyed, leaving Western civilization ripe for the picking, for the pagans and the heathens and the humanists who desire our blood. And we have surrendered to them in our churches, in our governmental institutions, and as we can see here, in the homes of Britain. They've surrendered to the humanists and the liars. Okay, we got to finish this story. At Zach's school, they address him as a girl. And his mom says she likes that. She likes that they address him as a girl at school because that's what he wants. And he must have what he wants, right? I mean, this is how far we've fallen, ladies and gentlemen. Even the drugged up Rolling Stones in the 1960s knew that you can't always get what you want. But modern day parents, they don't have a clue, for crying out loud.
Parents.
What's that? Oh, yeah, parents. I don't know. You know what? It never mentions a father. Now that I go through the story.
She doesn't have a husband.
She doesn't have a church. Naturally, she's going to go to a drug dealer, better known as a doctor in Britain. A psychopathic drug dealer referred to in this article as a dedicated specialist. There you have it. That's a good observation. I didn't pick that up. There was too much other things going on in that story. No father. Fathers have abandoned their children. And so the heathens and the government and the drug dealers are going to step in and take care of the kids. Yeah, they'll take care of them. All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. So many people feel that Texas could be the last great hope for civilization on the planet. Well, there's a Dallas County judge. During a February 21st meeting, Dallas County Judge Tanya Parker told the Stonewall Democrats of Dallas that while she has the power to perform legal marriage ceremonies, she will not do so. Yes, she says she refuses to marry heterosexuals. Do we have a quote from the fine judge, Tanya? We have actual video. No, audio. Actual audio? Let's roll.
I use it as my opportunity to give the boys a lesson about marriage inequality in this state. Because I feel like I have to tell them why I'm turning people away. So I usually offer to a couple, you know, something along the lines of, hey, I'm sorry, I don't perform marriage ceremonies. Because we're in a state that does not have marriage equality, and until it does, I'm not going to participate and apply the law to one group of people that doesn't apply to another group of people. It's kind of oxymoronic for me to perform ceremonies that can't be performed for me, so I'm not going to do it. Unquote. It's a lesbian judge there. probably taking some sex-changing hormones or something. She says, I do not perform marriages because it is not an equal application of the law, period, she said. This is a quote to the Dallas Voice, which is a queer newspaper there in Dallas, you know, the Village Voice and all that. During the meeting, Judge Parker also mentioned other steps she takes to promote equality for homosexuals, lesbians, transgendered, garden variety, sodomites, and other freaks, including adding the word partner to the list of people the jury is not supposed to communicate with about an ongoing case, and she admonishes attorneys who use the terms child molester and homosexual interchangeably. Well, that's kind of encouraging to know that in Texas that there are some people who use the word child molester and homosexual interchangeably. Maybe there is some hope in Texas. Judge Parker was elected in 2010 and is the first lesbian to be elected as a county judge in Dallas. Well, what are the odds she'll keep her job after all this comes out? Probably pretty good, because this too shall not pass, ladies and gentlemen. No, it will not. The homosexuals' rage and rebellion will only increase the longer it's tolerated. It's kind of like fanatical Islam wanting to take over the world. I mean, it's coming at us from both sides, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, the walls are coming tumbling down, ladies and gentlemen. And it's frankly, it's because the church has stepped out of the gap. And there's just a few of us left here crying out, trying to hold up the walls. But it ain't easy. All right. Speaking of people dedicated to saving the world, let's talk about PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Every year, PETA takes in tens of thousands of pets who've been discarded or abused, and they raise a lot of money sending out fundraising letters telling people how they're helping to save pets who've been abused, animals who've been abused on farms. Well, according to the Daily Caller, documents published online this month show that People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals killed more than 95% of the pets in its care in 2011. That's right. Records show that since 1998, PETA has killed more than 27,000 animals at its headquarters in Norfolk, Virginia. PETA killed about 2,000 cats and dogs last year alone, but they did find homes for 24 pets. Meanwhile, they sent out approximately 1 million direct mail pieces, and PETA has an annual budget of $37 million. Yeah. You know, they're similar, I think, to the Susan G. Komen Foundation, the National Right to Life Committee. They've become a part of a fundraising industry, a guilt amelioration industry. If you feel bad because you're not helping animals, just send some money to PETA. If you feel bad because you were involved in an abortion, well, send some money to National Right to Life. You can ameliorate your guilt, and there's a whole industry for that, and they make lots of money. But these organizations are completely unmoored from their founding. They have no connection to the purpose for which they were founded. They're just about making money. Unlike Ashley Madison. Ashley Madison is dedicated to making money, but they are completely committed to their founding principles of facilitating adulterous affairs and destroying the country. So the left is rising, and it's not a fad. It's not going to go away unless you and I stand up, speak the truth, get out there on the streets and do something about it, because we're the last ones left standing in the gap, ladies and gentlemen. And I got to tell you, I'm glad to have you with me. I mean, I hope you're with me, is what I'm saying. But I'm out of here. That's it for this week, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank my friends at KGOV, KGov.com, Denver Bible Church, Personage USA, American Right to Life, Colorado Right to Life, and Theology Online. And, of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week, should the Lord tarry. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.